Hi everyone, I'm Jessica.
And I'm Morgan.
You are listening to Suspicion.
Hello.
Hi, Morgan, how you doing?
I am so tired.
Me too. I'm very tired today.
I think I'm beat down from this weekend. We had 4th of July weekend, and we were outside the whole day, and we put together a competition series, and we ate so much food that I just feel so exhausted.
Yeah, the sun just beating down. I got a really bad sunburn yesterday, which never happens to me because I'm diligent about sunscreen. So yeah. I think all that stuff is draining, but it was an awesome weekend, and mm-hmm. we're happy to be back with more survival stories.
Yes. So we've decided that from here on out, is that the saying?
Yeah.
Here on out, we are going to try to keep focusing on survivor stories.
Yeah, we really enjoyed doing last week's episode. It's just nice when everyone is okay at the end.
I know. And I mean, even if it's like one person out of many who survive, it's nice to have a little breathing.
Hope and,
yeah.
Yeah, agreed. Mm-hmm. So we're excited to bring two new stories, and I'm going to get us started this week for another story of someone being lost at sea. So Morgan talked about this story a little bit last episode when I was asking about what's the longest someone had survived at sea. And she told us that Jose Alvarenga had survived the longest. And so I decided to dive a little bit deeper into the story and figure out what the deal was. And I have the scoop for everyone now.
Yes.
So let's do it.
Give it to us.
Jose Alvarenga was an experienced fisherman when he set out in late 2012 on a planned 30-hour deep-sea fishing shift to catch sharks, marlins, and sailfish.
That sounds
bringing
horrible.
These fish. That sounds great. Bringing these fish back to the fishing village of Costa Azul, Mexico, would land Alvarenga a hefty sum of money. But from the beginning, things were not going as planned. Alvarenga's equally experienced fishing partner backed out at the last minute, leaving Alvarenga to find a younger and more inexperienced fisherman to go out with, Ezequiel Cordova. Given the trip was relatively short and they would be decently close to shore throughout, Alvarenga didn't really think the lack of experience would be an issue. So on November 17th, 2012, the two set out on a 24-foot fiberglass boat with a small motor. They packed lightly, taking various fishing tools, a portable radio, a large icebox for the fish, and meager supplies of food. The trip was really fruitful, leading to the catch of over 1,000 pounds of fish, almost overloading the icebox they had brought. But as they attempted to return home, disaster struck. A storm began that lasted 5 days. Oof. And throughout, Alvarenga and Cordova tried to steer the boat back to shore, but it was hopeless as they couldn't even see the shore through the rain. They dumped all their recently caught fish in an attempt to maneuver the boat more easily, but to no avail. Over the 5 days, they survived on rainwater and minimal food they packed. At the end of the 5 days, the rain let up and the men were able to assess the damage, finding that their motor was gone, their fishing gear was either lost or damaged, and most of their electronics were damaged. They had enough charge in their radio to get a mayday signal to their counterparts on land, but not enough information to establish their location or enough charge to give much more. Alvarenga and Cordova were officially stranded.
Did they not have sails?
Mm-mm, it's a motorboat.
Oh, Oh my God, losing your motor, I would freak out.
So would I. Luckily, Alvarenga was really comfortable at the sea. Cordoba, a little less so, which we'll see how that kind of plays out. Mm. They really hoped their mayday message would result in a rescue, but they had no guarantee, so they started to figure out how to manage to survive off the sea. Like I said, Cordoba had little experience as a fisherman, so he couldn't really help in this effort. But Alvarenga was very experienced and was able to catch fish, turtles, jellyfish, and even seabirds with his bare hands.
Wow.
Yeah. This is, again, when we're talking about, like, having some solid survival skills in the right environment just goes a long way. Which, exactly. Again, you'll see play out throughout
and,
the story.
And also, we don't have.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. Definitely not at sea. When they could, they collected rainwater, but typically they had to drink a mixture of turtle blood and their own urine to stay hydrated.
What? How would you even think of that mixture?
Again, he knows what to, what like you can and can't drink and eat at sea.
Also, he that's knew so
that they couldn't have any salt water, which I think most people, if you don't know that, you cannot drink seawater. It will just dehydrate you and kill you.
I was actually telling our niece about that. We went to the beach last week, and I was explaining to her about that. Just I said, don't drink salt water. Never drink it.
Don't drink it, yeah. It dehydrates you. It messes with your GI system. You'll get sick, which will dehydrate you more. It's bad news. So they steered clear of that, but had to drink this pretty nasty-sounding mixture. Ugh. I know.
Do you think you could? Like, do you think you could drink that if you were in that situation?
If I need to survive, I can do whatever it takes. I will do whatever it takes.
Such a gag reflex.
No, you'd do it. Maybe the first time you tasted it, you'd struggle, but you would do it.
Yeah, you're right.
What's your other option? I mean, I'm sure when you got to shore, you had rainwater. It was so good, like the best thing you've ever had. But
I know. I think I would like, I mean, I would do it, but I would probably in my mind bank on rainwater, just getting as much rainwater as I could.
Yeah. I mean, that's what they tried to do, but that's a dangerous game to only rely on. Days turned into weeks, and week turned into months, and the two remained stranded at sea. They had given up on a rescue mission, but they were hoping that maybe a ship would happen upon them or a plane would spot them. But with no means of navigation, it felt unlikely. Alvarenga grew up spending most of his life at sea, so he was able to quickly adjust to this new seafood diet and reliance on the elements, but Cordoba was not. By the fourth month of being adrift, Cordoba became mentally and physically drained. He began to get sick from eating raw seafood and eventually just stopped eating. He ended up dying of starvation.
Ooh.
After 4 months. Alvarenga left Cordoba's body untouched for 6 days after he died.
Oh.
And the effects of being alone for the first time in months left Alvarenga contemplating suicide.
Yeah.
But finally, he was able to renew his faith and his strength and realize it was time to dispose of Cordoba's body. Alvarenga continued on after this in his survival efforts for another 10 months alone at sea. Crazy. After 438 days at sea, he finally saw land. He had drifted and landed upon a remote corner of the Marshall Islands, which was about 6,000 miles from where his journey began. Alvarenga managed to find a small beach house where he told his tale to a couple who quickly phoned the authorities. I'm realizing it might be helpful to give a little bit of an idea of where the Marshall Islands are, if you don't know. So he left off at Costa Azul in Mexico, which is, I guess if you're looking at Mexico, it is on the lower left side of the country. And he ended up drifting all the way across the Pacific Ocean. And the Marshall Islands are somewhere between Hawaii and Australia, if you can picture that.
Okay.
So south of Hawaii, north of Australia, of course. So it's far, clearly 6,000 miles. And in, if you, you know, look at a map in that part of the Pacific Ocean, I mean, you wouldn't have happened upon anything. If he was a little bit more north, he would have been probably out at sea for another 438 days.
Oh my God.
A little bit more south, probably another, I'm going to guess like 1,000 or so days. If he was too south, maybe just miss it altogether. I mean, it's insane.
It's kind of luck that plays into it as well. I mean, you can have all of these survival techniques and you could survive alone a certain number of days, but if you don't have just a little bit of luck, you're screwed.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. You can look, we'll post a link to the Guardian article where I'm looking at this specific map. So if you go on our website, you can find that and take a peek because
I would like to look at that, yeah.
His family was overjoyed at his return, but other people were initially very skeptical of Alvarenga's story. I say that in quotes as if it's made up. They claimed that he looked too, like, healthy.
Stop.
To have been at sea for over a year.
Oh my
so
God.
While he was thin, they had expected him to be, you know, truly emaciated. And people were claiming he would have had scurvy if he had been at sea for over a year and this and that.
How do you know? You don't know.
They also claimed that it would have been nearly impossible for him to have hit the Marshall Islands with no steering or navigation because they're saying you would have had to essentially sail in exactly straight line to hit those two points.
Okay.
But doctors pointed out that his diet at sea actually would have been fairly rich in vitamin C, which means he wouldn't have gotten scurvy. He was thin, but because he was a really experienced fisherman, he was able to eat better than probably the average person who was out at sea. And a University of Hawaii study showed how ocean currents would have gotten him from Mexico to the Marshall Islands.
Okay.
Alvarenga also had to deal with a lawsuit by Cordoba's family. They claimed, which there was no way they would have been able to know this, so it's confusing. They claimed that Alvarenga did not dispose of Cordoba's body, but instead ate him to survive.
What?
Yeah,
Also,
I guess they're just upset and going after whoever they can, but.
But also, I mean, that is another kind of horrible thing that people who need to survive might have to do.
Didn't we just talk about this last time, saying if we could eat each other?
Well, I know that throughout our life, we always have told each other that, well, actually, I always say that if I died, you could eat me. And you always say that if you died, don't touch you.
As much as I say that, I would totally encourage you to eat me if it was a situation, but again,
thank you.
You just won't be in that situation.
Now, Alex,
we're not really risky.
if we were on like a deserted island and you died, could I eat your body if I needed it?
Yeah.
Thanks.
Well,
That's true love. That's why they're getting married.
Yep, true love.
Alvarenga eventually took a lie detector test to disprove this, and it seems like it was settled. Alvarenga now lives in El Salvador, and from one of the articles it says he lives in a small town surrounded by land, as far from water as he can get.
Oh my gosh, that is actually hilarious, because that is kind of the exact end of my story.
Okay.
Like, he says the same thing.
Same thing. Okay. Yeah. Well, what is your story?
Well, that was so interesting, and I just can't even believe being stuck somewhere for longer than a day and then to be stuck in the open ocean for that long.
No, I mean, the mental and physical toll that must take on you is unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, and I would totally agree with him. I would never look at water again. I wouldn't go to the beach.
Maybe like a pool.
Yeah, something that's not salt water.
Pool. Yeah, I mean, nothing with waves or no. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's kind of funny that we are doing these two stories about two guys who are lost at sea, because Alex and I did watch Castaway like a few days ago. So I'm thinking of Castaway too, how at the end. Have you seen Castaway?
I've never seen Castaway.
Are you serious? I saw it once and I didn't like it. I thought it was boring, but it's Alex's favorite movie. So then I watched it again and now I love it.
All right, I'll give it a try. Is there a streaming service I can watch it on?
We have an HBO Max trial.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
All right, well, so my story for today, I actually saw it on Reddit. It was on one of those Today I Learned subreddits. I love that subreddit, Today I Learned. And the reason why I clicked on it was because it had a video of a diver diving through a boat. All of a sudden, a man's hand comes out of the darkness and grabs the diver's hand. This is the story of Harrison Okene. Harrison was 29 years old on May 26, 2013. He would then become the only person in the world to survive on the sea floor. Yeah, the bottom of the ocean.
I'm never going on the ocean again.
I know, me neither. Okay. So he was a cook on a tugboat that helped oil tankers off the coast of Nigeria on the Gulf of Guinea. The boat he was on was called the Jackson 4. And early in the morning, around 5 a.m. on May 26, a rogue wave capsized it. So there were a couple issues at the beginning. Due to pirate issues off the coast of Nigeria, there were policies put into place for these boats, like tugboats, commercial boats, whatever, oil tankers, all of that, that when crew members are sleeping or they're in their bedrooms, their areas, they have to lock the doors. So when the boat capsizes, every crew member on the boat, it's 5 a.m., they're all sleeping, they had to first realize that it's sinking, go to their doors, unlock their doors, and then pull open their doors against the water. However, Harrison just so happened to have woken up early to go to the bathroom. Okay. So he was out of his bedroom when the boat capsized. So he's in the bathroom, he's able to force the door open. He's only in his boxer shorts, nothing else. as he forces the door open, he can actually see some of his crew members escaping up the escape hatch. And so he's wants to, you know, get there to the escape hatch, but the force of the water as the boat's sinking down, it pulls him into the adjoining bathroom, into another bathroom.
Yeah. It's crazy because I obviously know that he ends up on the bottom of the sea floor. Mm-hmm. But yet, while I'm listening to you say this, I'm like, just get to the escape hatch.
I know.
You know what I mean? I'm like, yeah. You got it. You can do it.
Exactly. And exactly.
You're not going to end up on the sea floor. I'm like rooting that it's not going to happen.
But even though I know. It's crazy. So he is in this bathroom and the boat is upside down. So he is holding on to the bottom of the toilet. It was an exposed toilet. So he was holding on to like the pipes at the bottom of it to keep his head above the water. And it just so happened that there was an air pocket in this bathroom. So he was able to keep his head above the water. After about a day in that position, in the bathroom, he decides that he has to swim to another room. He can't stay there. So he decides to leave his air pocket to find a way out, or I don't know, go to another room. He ends up swimming to the engineering room, shout out to engineers, where he finds another air pocket, which is like so lucky.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this one was about 4 feet from the ceiling to the water. So it was a little bit bigger for him. When he got there, he was freezing cold.
Mm-hmm.
He was at the bottom of the ocean and he was only in his boxers. So he was able to strip off pieces of the wall. And he used those wall pieces plus a mattress that was floating in this room. And he was able to kind of make himself, I want to say almost like the door in the Titanic that Rose and Jack are on, where he was able to lift up the top half of his body so that only like some blood could circulate and he could get warm.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so let's talk about while he's there.
So it's been over 24 hours.
It's been over 24 hours, yeah. While he's in there, the thing that really grossed me out the most was that because of the salt water, his tongue started to rot.
Mm-hmm.
Also, while he was there, he was hearing a ton of noise of, you know, pieces of the rooms like banging into the walls, but he also heard the sounds of fish eating the dead crew members.
Oh
yeah, that was really not good for his mental state.
Morale. Yeah.
Yeah. He to get through it, he just kept thinking about his family. He was married and he was very, very religious. So he prayed to God a lot. And kind of going along to your story, he prayed to God and said, "If you get me out of this, I will never step foot on a boat again." Because they were a tugboat in kind of a busy area, and there were other tugboats there, those big oil tankers, people saw the rope wave hit them. And so immediately there was a rescue mission that came about. However, unfortunately, it was really hard for the divers to go all the way down because the rescue divers that were there, they could only go a certain depth. He was about 100 feet below the surface, on the ocean floor, and their like oxygen tanks and stuff couldn't get them all the way down there.
Okay.
So originally the rescue mission was put on hold after the first day because they didn't see any signs of life and they also didn't have the equipment to get there. But then there's a new rescue mission, an operation for divers to go and retrieve bodies.
Okay. So they were like, there's no way.
Yeah. Yeah. So this group of divers, they were actually Dutch divers, and they were tasked with going down to the shipwreck and collecting the corpses, basically.
Okay.
The divers get down to the bottom, and it was really hard for them to go through the ship because the spot that they it had landed was really muddy, and there was a lot of like silt and organisms and stuff, so it was really dark and it was hard to see. And then also the boat was upside down. So everything that is usually, you know, on the floor is now on the ceiling. Mm-hmm. So they're going through and they're collecting the bodies when Harrison actually sees a light go past his doorway in the hallway. So the first day that divers were able to get down to the boat, they were like knocking on the boat and he could hear that, and he was knocking on the walls back, but they didn't hear him. Mm-hmm. Same when the divers got down and they're starting to go through the boat and collect corpses, he could hear knocking and stuff, and so he was knocking again, but nobody heard him. So when he saw that,
it's like, where's the sound gonna travel through?
Exactly, right?
yeah.
So when he saw that light go past, he knew it was a diver. But this diver went too fast past him. However, this diver turned around and came back that way. And the diver later said that he thought it was a dead body. And he thought it was a dead body's hand reaching at him. So he kind of like went to grab it too. And then he said it freaked him out when that hand like grabbed onto him, because he knew this guy, someone's alive. So he radioed to all of the other divers and they all went in to the air pocket where Harrison was, and they were just amazed that he had stayed alive. They also found him at the best time because the pressurized air pocket, it was starting to lose oxygen. Everybody knows, like, if you put a blanket over your head, there's only so long that you can breathe under it. Mm-hmm. The same thing here. There was nowhere for oxygen to be created. He was breathing out CO2. And the only thing that kept him alive was that he was splashing some of the water by, like, swimming. And that caused the water to collect some of the CO2 that he was breathing out. Yeah, crazy. But they said that the air pocket should have only lasted him 2.5 days. He was under there for about a little over 2.5 days. Wow. So this was the perfect timing. The divers gave him hot water. Like hot water bottles to warm him up, and then they had him on an oxygen mask. But then they had to figure out how to get him back up, because a lot of people probably have heard about how when you're a diver, you can't just swim right back up to the top of the ocean. You get the bends, so you have to kind of like go in increments.
Right.
And it was even more tricky because of the pressure down there, and he had been in that pressure for over 2.5 days. So they were really, really scared to bring him up. They were also worried that he was going to kind of freak out with the diving mask on, and that he was going to try to swim back up or like take his mask off or something. But he was actually very calm, and they said that he went along and listened to every instruction that they gave him. So eventually,
once you made it that long surviving, I'm sure you're like, I'll just wait a little longer. I'm going to be patient. I just want to get out of here.
I know. I don't know. I think I'd be like, get me out. Get me out.
I know. Like the panic response.
Panic, exactly. So they hook him up to a diving tank, an oxygen tank, and they bring him back up to the surface. He had thought that it had only been 12 hours when he got up there. He was like, oh, it's Sunday, right? And they said, no, it's May 28th, like 7 p.m. You've been under there for 2.5 days. He then had to spend another 2.5 days in a decompression chamber to get his body used to the pressure again. So after that, he made a full recovery and he went back to his hometown in Nigeria. They said something that was really kind of sad is that he had a lot of PTSD. And his wife said that he suffers from nightmares where he's like clawing out because he thinks that he's underwater. And something that I felt was really sad was that so there were 12 crew members on the boat, 10 bodies were found, and then Harrison was rescued. The search for the 12th body had to stop because the conditions were getting way too dangerous. Harrison did not go to any of the other crew members' funerals because they're in Nigerian culture. People thought that he had survived because of doing like voodoo magic. And so he just didn't want to go and face the scrutiny or the reactions of the families. Now he is a cook on land, and like I said, he has vowed to never set foot on a boat again. That's the story of Harrison Okene.
That's actually one of the craziest stories.
Yeah, I mean,
you're full on underwater.
Yeah.
I just don't, my mind cannot wrap around it. I understand the concept of air pockets and everything, but it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
That you survived down there.
Do you remember that movie that we used to watch when we were way too young to be watching that movie? But like the 1970s movie of the Poseidon Adventure?
Yes, yes.
Oh my God. Terrifying.
Very, very scary. I know.
Yeah, I was thinking about that when I was researching. Titanic. I refuse to go on a cruise boat.
I want to see land.
Yeah, same. And I also every time I'm away. Exactly. And I like a boat, but I don't trust the ocean.
Yeah. I mean, nature is unpredictable.
Ooh. All right. Well, I can't believe we both had C.
We'll mix it up next week.
Yeah, next week we'll do something different.
We'll give another thing for people to be scared of next week.
That's good. That's good.
Not just the sea. Every part of nature is scary, everyone.
never go outside. No. Listen to the Lonely Island song YOLO. And yes. You only live once. Yeah.
So don't mess it up.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and a lot of the information I got about this story, from Reddit, but also there's a really good YouTube show. It's only about 10 minutes long. It's the infographic show, and you just type in his name, and I'll put a link to it on our website. But it gives a really good depiction of what he went through. Like cartoons and stuff.
Cool.
It was really cool. And he's done a number of interviews as well.
All right. I'll check that out.
Yeah. All right. So our organization for this week, since we both did ocean stories, is Oceana. Oceana is dedicated to protecting and restoring the world's oceans on a global scale. They seek to make our oceans more biodiverse and abundant by winning policy victories in the countries that govern much of the world's marine life. Founded in 2001, it's the largest international advocacy organization focused solely on ocean conservation. Their offices around the world work together to win strategic directive campaigns that achieve measurable outcomes. They'll help make our oceans more biodiverse and abundant. If you want to learn more about them, you can go to oceana.org. But something I found really interesting going through their website is that they're not only focused on cleaning and conserving the ocean for, you know, just the nature of it, but also so that people can use the fish that live in the ocean to feed themselves. So they're also working on supporting people who are suffering from hunger and food shortages. So really cool organization.
Yeah, as scary as the ocean is, we need to protect it. So everyone take care of your oceans.
Yeah, your favorite animals are whales.
Yes, it's true.
Mm-hmm. Like a particular whale?
Just whales. I like the concept that they could swallow me whole. I think that's impressive.
Yeah.
On that note,
I can't believe he didn't know that.
Learn something new every day.
That's true. That's true.
Hence, today I learned the Reddit subreddit.
Oh, I love that subreddit. It's so interesting. That's what I go down holes in. Is that subreddit?
Reddit will do that to you, yeah.
That one, and I really like Tales from the Front Desk about hotel workers. Mm-hmm. Oh, so, I don't know why, but I find it fascinating.
Crazy customers.
Oh, that's a good one, Dev. If you need something, it's interesting the things that they deal with. Like you wouldn't imagine.
Those are our two subreddit recommendations for this week.
For this week on subreddit recommendations.
Yes. All right, Morgan. Oh, well,
all right.
I eat dinner. So
same. All right. Well, thanks everyone for listening. Jess, thanks for looking up that story.
Thanks for telling us about your story as well. And thanks, everyone. I hope you like the stories. We'll have more survival stories for you coming every 2 weeks. And
if you have any interesting stories that you found, survival stories, please send them to us. We have an email, suspicion@gmail.com. You can also reach us through our website at suspicion.com. And I'm also always checking our Instagram, Suspicion. Oh, and Facebook.
Suspicion. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks,
Mo. And stay suspicious. Yay!
I did it.